Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome.
Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas. It's The Stacks Book Club Day. We're discussing The Office of Historical Corrections by Danielle Evans this week in detail, which is code for, yes, there are spoilers today. Our guest is National Book Award finalist Deesha Filya, author of The Secret Lives of Church Ladies. Today, we're diving deep into this story collection, so if you haven't read the book yet, listen at your own risk. I also want to take a moment to congratulate both Deesha and Danielle for their collections being finalists for the Story Prize. In case you missed it last week, Danielle Evans was our guest on the podcast to discuss The Office of Historical Corrections without spoilers, so that's a perfect listen for anyone who hasn't quite finished the book yet. Be sure to listen until the end of today's episode to find out our book club pick for February. If you want more discussion around the Office of Historical Corrections and all of our book club picks, consider joining the Stacks on Patreon. Patreon is a website where you can contribute monthly to help me make this show. In exchange for your generosity, you earn perks like our virtual book club, which is to say once a month, I will hop on a video chat with you and other members of the Stacks pack and discuss the Stacks book club pick. We talk about the book in detail and discuss conversations that come up on the podcast. If that sounds like something you'd be interested in, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join us. Shout out to some of our newest members of the Stacks pack. Christy Mandeville, Jenna, Renea Diamond, Naina Odaluga, Ashton Ballard, Cree Miles, Alexandra Ndegwa Rennebaum, Brittany, Ayana Close, and Amber. Thank you all so, so much for continuing to show the Stacks love. There would be no show without the Stacks pack. If you want to join, please head to patreon.com/thestacks. Okay, now it's time for the Stacks Book Club conversation of the Office of Historical Corrections with Deesha Filya. All right, everybody, I am back again with the author and wonderful all-around human, Deesha Filya. We're talking about The Office of Historical Corrections by Danielle Evans for the Stacks Book Club today. Deesha, welcome back to the Stacks.
Thanks so much, Tracy.
I'm just so excited. Okay, we're going to dive right in. For everyone listening, there will be spoilers today. So if you have not read the book and you think you want to read the book and you don't want to be spoiled, go ahead and pause this, go read, and then come back. We'll be here. Deesha and I will be very patient. We will wait for you. For everyone else, let's just dig in. We always start here just kind of generally. What did you think of the book?
So I was like, there were just like parts of the book where my mouth was just hanging open. So just stunning, like literally, you know, that's commonly used to describe, but I was so stunned in so many different places in these stories. And full disclosure, I've had a chance to meet Danielle. She's part of the Cambilio Fiction Fellow faculty. And the summer of 2017, when I was there, she was my faculty person. So I got to, you know, have a one-on-one session with her, which was really cool. And, you know, she's just super smart and just her, you know, the mind, right? Like every page, I was like, I never knew what she was going to do next. And so it's just such a smart collection and really stunning. So that's my overall perspective.
I'm with you. I know I said last time you were here that I don't like fiction and I rarely have nice things to say about it, but I fucking loved this collection. And I was really shocked because I thought, really, am I going to like two short story collections in 2020, like this is unheard of. I mean, truly, the book is so great. If I'm being like fully honest, I did not hit my stride with the story collection until story number three. So the first two stories, the first one I didn't really care about very much at all. The second one, I sort of was like, okay, there's some interesting things here. And then the third one, Boys Go to Jupiter, I was like, yo, I am here. I'm available. If anyone would like to hang out in this space for the rest of your life, like I will be here. And then from there, I just loved each story more and more. And then when I went back and started thinking about the first two, I liked them more. Understanding the collection, but I didn't, when I started it, I didn't like instantly fall in love with it. I was very skeptical. And then I was like, okay, this is great. because I feel like I generally don't like character driven either, but I feel like she was able to give a lot about her characters and still have plot and still have things happen and still keep me interested in what they were going to do or think or say, which is really hard. And she also kept it short. I like when people can keep it short.
Yeah. And as somebody who writes short stories, like nailing that so succinct and that you leave people with, they can still have curiosities, but not, you know, like confusion, right?
Right.
And she nails that, like, we don't always know what's going to happen. I mean, you know, we can kind of guess and speculate, but everything felt satisfying. Like, yes. You know, I always talk about a story ending on a sigh, and that sigh could be like relief or it could be resignation or whatever, but that satisfaction. And I felt that with every story. The one that, like, when I was pulled in was the second story.
Okay.
Because there were just, you know, things that I didn't see coming. We talked about spoilers, like when the main character reveals that her sister has been murdered, like that.
Right. Well, no, you know, she wasn't murdered. She was shot, but she survived, remember? And she's a shell of herself.
But the shot, was like, it's such as the gunshot itself.
Right.
I had to like pause and read back. And like, did that really just happen? Yeah. But, you know, it was just so matter of fact, you know, and it was like, this poor woman is like in her grief. Like, you know, I felt the grief because of the way that she revealed, you know, what had happened to her sister. And yes, big, big difference. She's in a vegetative state, but she did not die.
That was a wow moment for me too. I wrote down in my notes, Connor shooting Rena's sister was a wow moment. That's what I wrote down.
and you know, it's funny because like you were saying, like, you know, connecting and I wasn't sure how I felt about Rena until then.
I didn't care. You know,
figure out what her deal was. Yeah. I mean, she was more likable than Dory in the wedding party, you know, so I was like, okay, there's a contrast there. But when I realized, oh, this is grief, you know, and then, you know, as someone who, you know, grieves, who currently has things that I grieve, like, she was my girl at that point, you know, she really was. And then, when the guy decides he doesn't want to get married. He's just going to, you know, sneak away like an asshole and then come back. I wanted to, oh my gosh. And so that was one of those moments of like, is she going to marry him? Is she, I mean, because clearly she didn't run back. And in the version of, in my head, that she doesn't marry him.
No. In the version in my head, Dory fully marries him in her little rainbow bridal party, which truly was like the detail. Like, that's what Daniel Evans does it so good, is like she leaves these like one sentence details where you're like, oh, I fully know that whole person's life. I know their social security number. Right. I know exactly what the house looks like. It was like the rainbow wedding party. Yeah. And she was like, what did the girl in orange do? And I was like, yes, because if I was orange, I'd be like, we're not friends. I'm not going to be in your wedding.
Yeah. That's like those just so super smart details that just are just satisfying throughout. And the, you know, it feels so like I read these stories and it felt, each one just was an intimacy, you know, and some stories you read and like from a craft perspective, they're, you know, flawlessly executed. But they lack the intimacy. And so these were flawless and intimate.
Yeah.
And, you know, she just nailed all of it. But yeah, all of the bridesmaids, I was like rolling my eyes, but I was like you said, but I knew who those people
instantly
were.
Yeah. It's that, I mean, that is like, I always have a hard time articulating what it is I do and don't like about fiction, but what that is, that like those little nuggets where you get to see a person completely in a sentence. To me, that is the best kind of fiction, because what I don't like about fiction is where it's like 5 pages on a detail. And I'm like, you couldn't figure out a better way to do that? Like, I really had to have this whole long sweeping explanation of what the girl in orange is like. All you have to say is that the bridesmaids are wearing rainbow colors to the bachelorette party. And I know who all 7 of them are.
Right.
And I know exactly who the girl in blue is. Even if you don't mention her again, I know who the girl in red is. Like, I get it. And that kind of like specificity and brevity and just like, It just shows me that Danielle Evans has done all the other work. Like, she might have 10 pages of text about the woman in orange, but I don't need to see your work.
Right. And it shows that she trusts us as readers.
Yes.
She trusts us to get it. She trusts herself as a writer, right? That she knew that, you know, if I did those, you know, I did all the writing I needed to do to find that detail, and that she trusted herself, like, this is going to nail it. And that she trusts us as readers, that she didn't have to explain things to us. And sometimes I look at those 5 extra pages, it's like, it's masturbatory.
Right.
You know, there's some people who just think it, and I call that overwriting.
Yeah.
And there is not a superfluous word or sentence or paragraph in this entire collection.
I agree. Like, you're never like, ugh, get to it already. You know, like the pacing is always like, as soon as you're ready to kind of shift, she shifted.
Yeah.
As soon as you're ready. Yeah. Like, I feel like that happened a lot in the story. Anything could disappear with, as soon as like Vera was like starting to annoy me, or like I was starting to be like, okay, what's going to happen? It was like, oh, just this little thing's changed. And all of a sudden I'm like, okay, let me get resituated. And I mean, that story to me, I loved. And that story is a movie. Right? Like, that story to me is total. Do you ever watch the show Narcos?
No, I'm sorry, not
Narcos. What's the other? I get them confused because it's like people talking about drugs. Ozark with Patrick Bateman.
No.
Anyways, there's this white girl with curly hair in it, and she's like a great actress. And she, to me, is this Vera character. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. I just could picture her. But in that story, Danielle Evans does such a good job of like keeping the pacing going. She lets us get to know Vera enough. Like, we understand, you know, what's happening, but she doesn't sit in it. It doesn't become heavy. It doesn't become like laborious. It has that play. And it just,
the setup itself was heavy enough.
Yeah.
So you're holding your breath anyway the whole time because you're waiting for the other shoe to drop, because it was just such a wonderful set of circumstances and problems.
Right.
And you're like, this is a house of cards. I don't want to even breathe because I, you know, it's going to blow down at some point.
Right.
And so then she just had a light hand because she didn't really need to, you know, be heavy at that point. I'm sorry, you were about to say something.
No. I love that. I think you're so right. It is that overwriting that sometimes like gets in people's way. And I mean, I experience that as a podcast. Like, when I ask questions, sometimes I go on too long because I don't know what I'm trying to say. Right. And it's like, she is so easy and like, so, I'm sure it's not easy to do. Right. Of course it's hard. And I'm sure she has pages and pages of things that don't exist to us. But the ability to edit and to clean and to strip away is just, as for me as a reader, it's all I ever want. I don't want to see any of your work. It's like one of the things, I went to theater school. So I, you know, acting is like one of the ways that I can explain, you know, craft to myself. And there's so many actors where it's like, I see the work you've done, right? Like, I see that you walked around New York City in character because you're a method actor. And like, I don't want to see that. I want an actor who's just so effortless that I really think that you are that person, right? Mm-hmm. And like, she is that kind of writer to me. It's just like effortless, even though, again, I know she worked really hard. I guess we should, I'm just curious. Did you have favorite and least favorite stories?
So I was prepared initially to say that my favorite story was Richard of York Gave Battle in Vain, the second story.
Okay.
And then I read the novella.
Okay.
So maybe it's not even, you can't, maybe that's apples and oranges.
Like, no, I think you can include the novella.
But the novella aside, it was the Rena and Dory story, because again, those like just really light touches, the brevity of it, the characterization, And the way that she complicated the situation, like it would have been so easy if it had been a thing of, you know, Rena and the, and I keep forgetting the guy's name, but yeah. You know, she didn't sleep with him, but that right. would, you know, so the thing we kind of expected, the right. thing Dory expected, right. you know, didn't happen. You know, the fact that he was going to bail on the wedding, didn't see, you know, any of that coming. And she made me care about people that, normally, if you had just sort of described these people, I would have been like, and so, you know, but right. she immediately, you know, complicated things in a way that I was all in. So that would be my favorite. That's tough to say least favorite, because there wasn't an obvious one where I was right. like, and, you know, there was nothing like that. The one that I think, like, if I had to pick one, I would say Happily Ever After.
Yeah.
I felt like the others just had more meat or something. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say. But the characters in the, you know, the main character in Happily Ever After, she's not one that stuck with me. I didn't connect with her the way I did with the other characters. And even the other ones, I might have not even particularly liked them, but I can, you know, yes. I felt something, and so I, that would be the only one. But even yeah. that was just a really well executed story. That intimacy again,
yeah,
being, you know, the women, you know, so throughout, of course, you know, there are women characters, and the sense of certain, I don't know if searching is the right word. And maybe this is my own bias because I write about dissatisfied women, but, you know, I see dissatisfaction right. all up and through this collection.
Yeah, of course.
And sort of like, so I think her, the main character in Happily Ever After, like her dissatisfaction just wasn't Lissa, I didn't connect with it as much.
Right. I agree. That one was, I think, my least favorite, but my second least favorite was probably Richard York gave Battle in Vain. While I loved the Connor moment, the Connor shooting the sister, I was really like stopped in my tracks by that mm-hmm. moment. Overall, mm-hmm. that story didn't do a ton for me. Like I liked mm-hmm. it, but I wasn't like super into it. Those first two just really didn't quite, mm-hmm. I don't know. They just weren't working for me. My favorite, I think, is probably definitely Boys Go to Jupiter. I just yeah. love that one. I just, because I loved how she just fucking nailed Claire, the girl. That I know that girl. I have met that yeah. girl. I have unfortunately had to have that girl on my DMs in the last year. Like I know that person. That when she talks about how Claire is distrust collective anger, but then I'm goes ahead and does her little passive aggressive bitchy ass yes. sliding the thing under the door. And I'm like, oh, you distrust collective anger. Oh, wow. Except for you get to yeah. have your anger. You get to have your like, and I just, and yeah, even like the shit with the mom and the cancer. And like, I understand that Danielle Evans was trying to give her more life so that we would feel sympathy for her. But even mm-hmm. that, I didn't feel sympathy for her because I understood like where it was coming from. And like, of course, I feel sympathy that her mother died of cancer when she was in high school. Right. Of course. But it was like, you're still a terrible person and you're still mm-hmm. so selfish and you're still like all of these things. And I loved hating her and I loved just like, and I love mm-hmm. the complexity that she built into that story, how I yeah. can imagine that certain readers will read that story very differently than how I did. And I loved that mm-hmm. part of it. Like, I thought it was so good. Like, just, I loved it.
It was such a commentary on whiteness.
Such a commentary.
And white womanhood in particular, like the very last part where she basically is like, you know, she could be whoever she wanted to be. She could, you know, mm-hmm. that she's still, even in that moment of being diminished and having to be accountable, she still had agency. She still had a measure of control. You know, when she said what, you know, the part about not, you know, not liking collective anger, what a dog whistle, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm, about, you know, because mm-hmm. Black folks, we are collectively angry.
Right. We don't get to have individual personal anger.
Right. And so that was such a dog whistle. And I feel like, you know, we don't always get that look inside, you know, because I read that story with like two views. Like, we were in her head. And then I kept imagining, and Danielle made it easy because she showed us how the rest of the world was seeing her. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can fill in any black girl, any white girl who got caught in blackface or whatever it is. Right. And, you know, there's the public face, the non-apology, the defensiveness and all of that. And then you see on the interior, even when there's no maliciousness, there's still this disaffectedness, disaffectation, mm-hmm. where there's just not the concern. Like, she still sees herself as the victim, you know,
exactly.
in all of this. And even with her best friend having been black. So this is proof. Having a best friend be black means nothing.
Means nothing.
I could not get past, and this is not a criticism, I'm just saying that it's my criticism of the character, not the story. This is, again, we talked about this when I was talking to you previously about my book and other topics, how white supremacy affects all of us, mm-hmm. and like the history, like, but we, and usually it's white folks who don't know the history. So they think they're being individuals. Mm-hmm. So her affection for Angela's mother, mm-hmm. you know, black women have always had to take care of white children that are not theirs, you know? And so I was uncomfortable with that, but she had the, you know, those fond memories of, you know, being treated like one of the family and all of that. And all I could think is, she's not your mammy. You know, she tugged a lot of heartstrings because, yes, like you said, her mother did die and you're sympathetic and she is still a child, mm-hmm. but all of my issues with, you know, whiteness and white supremacy, like, she was like touching all the nerves.
Yeah. I mean, and it's like, so people listening to this conversation now will have heard my conversation with Danielle last week. So you guys will have heard us sort of talk about this story a little bit. But one of the things that I found interesting, and I think about a lot, especially in 2020, this year of like racial reckoning and like discovering racism and all this shit, is that people assume, let me rephrase that, white people assume that these conversation topics are new or fresh, mm-hmm. or whatever. Mm-hmm. But Danielle Evans has been writing this story and these stories for years. And mm-hmm. so I just love and hate that this story feels so current, right? Like, of course it would have felt current 10 years ago too, but like, mm-hmm. in this moment of like, I didn't know wearing a Confederate flag was bad. Like, that whole thing is just, it just was like, oh, this story is so spot on for this exact moment. And I know she turned in her manuscript probably, you know, 6, 9, 12 months ago or whatever. But, and the thing about Claire and like the collective anger and the wearing of the bikini and then the sliding it under the door and the whole thing is that even still in her doing that, there is a justification and a train of thought that white people are able to follow that absolve any sort of blame or whatever. And I feel like Danielle Evans nails that too. Right? Like, it's like
the myth of white innocence.
Yes. It's like your best friend was black and you lived in Virginia and you didn't ever think that perhaps the Confederate flag wasn't a great idea.
Well, remember but again, it's all about the individual, because what she said, and this was probably in the first couple of lines, was, you know, I only wore it to piss off
Bunny,
you know, my stepmom.
Or whatever her name Puppy. Was. Puppy.
Yeah. You know, to piss off my stepmom. And so there's always some bullshit innocence excuse, you know, but there's never a moment that says it doesn't matter why I did it.
Right.
It was wrong.
Or, oh my God, I didn't realize how upset someone might be because of this.
Right.
It's like, but oh, well, I always said hi to her in the hallway.
Yeah.
Like the black girl. Okay, wait, but this is a good time to talk about, because you mentioned that you talk about writing the other. First, yeah. Do no harm. I'm curious what you think about this story from that perspective of folks, of Danielle Evans being a Black woman writing this white character.
Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's a comparison, right? Because Black people, like, we have to know white people better than they know themselves.
Right.
And so we get to write about white people with authority. And I was in a conversation with someone else, some other writers, about this idea of writing about from perspective that's not yours. And it usually goes wrong because what you can't research is nuance. Mm-hmm. And what you can't research and get it right is joy, mm-hmm. right? And so that's why we often, when people write the other, quote unquote, mm-hmm. it's the pathology, it's the trauma porn, it's the slavery, it's the, you know, that stuff, because that's what they see. And that's what it reduces usually people of color to, and Black people in particular. So when the tables are turned, we know the nuance of whiteness, mm-hmm. you know, we've had to know it to survive.
Yeah.
You know, we had to be able to predict what they're going to do. We've had to read their minds,
right.
you know?
Right.
And so, you know, I feel like Danielle has the authority here to do that, in a way that if the reverse was true, I don't think that authority exists, and there's the potential for harm. There's no potential for harm, you know, just from a power perspective. Danielle isn't going to harm white people by writing about them in a particular way. It just won't happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I also think, like, again, I like that in this collection, the characters that are kind of like our protagonists in each story, she mm-hmm. moves between protagonists, Black protagonists, white protagonists. Rena, it's sort of, I'm not exactly sure what ethnicity Rena is. I think she's a person of color, but I don't think that she's clearly a Black woman. And I sort of like that she plays around with that.
Rena described herself as Black, Polish, and you know, something, another nationality. Okay. But I assume that she was white presenting because nobody else mentioned her Blackness. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So, or like she's like ethnically ambiguous sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. That's good. Sometimes I miss some of like the little details, but I sort of like not necessarily knowing the race of the character right off mm-hmm. the bat, and sort of trying to navigate what the power struggle is or the power yes. structure is in the stories. And so I found that to be sort of fun in this collection because I was doing that, like, okay, what? Once she introduced Claire, then I was like, oh, is this person white? Is this person not white? Oh, doing this. And I sort of loved that about the collection. Like, this, she's sort of playing a game with us also.
Right. Because, you know, how do you read the character differently when you think, you know? Right. And then, and also in Alcatraz, mm-hmm. I forgot that her mother was Black.
Right. Yeah. And that one was a little confusing too.
Yeah. And so that gave me something to interrogate about myself. Like, I was told she was Black, mm-hmm. but then, you know, I lost it somewhere. So, you know, there were just so many great layers there in that story in general, but that in particular.
Yeah. Well, one of my questions about that story is, I don't know if she says it explicitly, and I was sort of trying to figure out, the mother, who is the Black child of in this white family.
Yes.
So the mother has a white mother. So there's a white grandmother, but a Black mother. Was the father a Black person, or was the whole family passing?
Okay. I went back a couple of times because I had that exact question. So where I think I landed was that Papa, the grandfather, was white.
Yes.
And then the father, so the main character's grandfather, who was, we never saw him,
right.
the main character, he was Black, but was absent.
Okay.
You know, she came home, what is the line? She came home with a Black baby.
Yes.
You know, not with a Black boy, but with, you know, a Black man, but with a Black baby. So that, I think that was the only Black person. Uh-huh. But then I don't know if the main character's father was Black.
Right. We don't, we know that the main character is at least like some percentage Black, but we don't know if it's one half, one quarter, right. three quarters.
Right. Unless, we just know that her parents are divorced.
Right. We know her parents are divorced, and we know that her mom is half Black, half white.
Right.
Yeah. I liked that story. I think that was another one of the stories that I was really into, but it wasn't as specific for me. Like I wasn't like as obsessed with it, but I also, maybe because it came after Boys Go to Jupiter and I was like, oh my God,
like
Boys Go to
Jupiter. Now.
Yeah. I was like freaked out about, I was so in, but I did love like the tension and like the discomfort in that story. It just felt so awkward and like,
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, there was the mother-daughter dynamic there where, you know, her mother had, relied too heavily on her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you could sense the discomfort, but there was nothing where she ever confronted it. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, as soon as we got some glimpses of that mother-daughter dynamic, it was like, but let's look back at the racist, you know, family mm-hmm. members, or let's look back at Papa's, you know, the way that, you know, he was, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, just the horrible thing that he, right. that happened to him,
right.
you know? And so I wanted more of an arc between the mother and daughter. One of the things I just loved throughout this collection were the relationships between women. Mm-hmm. And I felt like this one kind of bounced around a little bit. So we have the main character starts to connect with her cousin. Mm-hmm. And then we have the Nancy and then the main character's mother. Mm-hmm. But I was just so much more interested in the main character and her mother.
Yeah.
And we just didn't get to see as much of that as I would have wanted. And I think that's one of the reasons that I like the second story is the relationship between Dory and Rena. Just, it's so unexpected. And
yeah.
I love that they went to a water park. I loved everything about that. I really, really did. So
I love that we had different takes on that one, because it's always fun for me when like someone loves something that I'm like, or vice versa. So I love that that's like your favorite one. And I mean, again, there's some wow moments in that story for sure.
Yeah.
We should take a pause.
Okay.
And then we'll come back and do some of the other stories. Libro FM is my audiobook platform of choice for one major reason, and that's because they allow me to purchase my audiobooks through my favorite independent bookstores. It's really that simple. I get to feel good knowing my audiobook purchases are going directly back into my community and supporting businesses that I love to frequent. Bookstores have been hit extra hard during this pandemic, and so being able to shop in a completely safe way and patronize my favorite bookstores from the comfort of my home is a no-brainer. Libro FM has over 180,000 audiobooks for you to choose from, so they're not skimping out on variety and options. Plus, they do so much to give back to their communities. And for anyone who's new to Libro FM, you can get two audiobooks for the price of one when you use the code THESTACKS, all one word, at checkout. All you have to do is head to Libro.fm and use the code THESTACKS to get two audiobooks for the price of one. Make the switch to Libro FM. Your favorite booksellers will thank you. We're back. What about why won't women just say what they want?
So I thought I wasn't going to like that.
I thought I wasn't either. And then I fucking loved it. I loved it.
I just thought
it was so fun. I loved how she named the characters in like these really specific ways and then kept going back to like the full sentence.
Yeah.
And I loved that it was sort of playful, but it was serious. And it was like such an incredible example of the ways that we are gaslit.
Woo!
The manipulation, the like all the whole, like the ways that she just wrote it out. I feel like a lot of the things that she was able to write out in mm-hmm. that story are the ways that women talk about each other and also the ways that we understand things but are never able to articulate. And I just like loved those two things. Like the names for the women is totally how we talk about each other, right? Like you go to your girlfriend and you're like, oh, the second wife you never really liked, or like, oh, you know. And then I love that like the one girl had her name.
Shannon.
Shannon. Like, and of course it's a Shannon. But did you think that he was black or did you think that he was white, the artist?
I thought he was white.
Me
and
too.
You know who I pictured? You know, in Bridesmaids, her fuck buddy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I had a same kind of disheveled hair situation.
Him. Him. And I felt like this story could have been called This Motherfucker. Mm-hmm. Like, just every, I was like, this motherfucker. And it's the things that men do and say. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you were saying, like, you know, the way that we women talk, you know, those names for the women were how women talk about each other. But the things that he said are the things that men say to us that I think sometimes we are too ashamed to repeat.
Right. We never talk about.
We did something wrong. You know, we haven't done anything wrong. But to, you know, to know that you stayed with somebody who talked to you that way, like it becomes your shame. And so this is an interesting twist because, you know, on the surface, at least, it's some accountability. Mm-hmm. Like we know he's full of shit still to the very end. But on the surface, there's this accountability and there's still something kind of gratifying about it. Even though it was all orchestrated, it shows he knew exactly what he was doing.
Mm-hmm. All along.
All along. He knew what was right. He knew right from wrong, you know, and then he didn't do the right thing until it could serve him, you know, in his art. But then, you know, there was that element of revenge fantasy that I was like, yes, this motherfucker got his.
And I loved what she did. So like, I think as I was reading it, I was like, why is he apologizing? Like, what's going on? Like, this is like so weird. What's going on? And I love that she really took it to like the furthest logical end, which was like, it was all for a piece of art. Because I think that we all have been in situations where someone, whether it was a man or a woman or whatever, treated us in a way, gaslit us, and then came back and apologized. And it's like, why are you doing this? Like, I had a girlfriend who I had a falling out with. And she, like, I let her know that she needed to stop talking about me, like this whole thing. We had like a real full conversation. And then like 9 months later, she reached out to me, was like, I would like to talk to you because I have some things I still want to say. And I was like, what is this bitch doing? And then I realized it was because I was about to be hosting a party for a mutual friend and she wanted to be included. And I did include her because it was the mutual friend's engagement party. You know, like I was like, whatever, I'm hosting it, but it's not my thing. But it was like that same moment of like, why are you here? Why do you have some things you want to get off your chest? You know, like, what is this about? And I love that she took it so far to this like satire place of like, it's for my art performance, like volcano. And it just, it was just so juicy, good and fun. And it was like in the perfect spot in the book. It was like the perfect.
You're ready for a little.
We needed a little after Alcatraz. Yeah. And then we got, you know, anything could disappear to kind of like bring us back down. And then we go into this novella. It just like the flow of the book in general is really good. Mm-hmm. And that particular story, I think on its own, I might not have loved it. But as part of this book, I just think it was like. Just again, like Danielle Evans understanding her audience, giving us credit, giving us what we need, taking care of us, just like, and the fact that he didn't think that anyone would push him in and then the like least assuming person did.
You're so lacking in self-awareness.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
It's just
And then, you know, that is his undoing.
Yeah.
Being, you know, lacking self-awareness ultimately was his undoing. And that just, again, there was that sigh. Mm-hmm. I was so satisfied at the end of that one.
So
I loved
good.
It.
It's so good. Okay. What do we have to say about Anything Could Disappear? And then we'll do the novella.
Yeah. I heard Danielle read from that.
Oh.
Which was great. That was really great. She just, you know, read a part of it. Well, one of the things I love about just stories in general and this one in particular is that idea of it just throws out the window your concept of right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have not yet satisfactorily answered if I would have handled it differently. If somebody, I mean, not me now, at my age and all of this, like, you know, I would figure something else out. I also would hope I wasn't a drug mule, but, you know, given those circumstances,
sure.
I mean, I don't think I would have wanted to turn this kid over either.
I would have been like, okay, let me go drop these drugs off because I'm not trying to get in trouble. And then I would have immediately taken the child to the fucking department, whatever. I would have been like, look, this kid is here. I don't fucking know. I am not interested in this. I want to just live in New York. Like, I am a 20 something. I am trying to be in New York City. I am trying to go have a beverage. I'm trying to go out at nighttime. Like, I'm not trying to be a mom at 20 to a stranger's 2-year-old. Like, are you kidding me? Goodbye. It's a hard no. And again, I would not be a drug mule, but I would definitely, if I was in that situation, I'm going to get my $10,000 because I made it this far. But like, truly, I was not interested in that baby. I loved the story. I loved how she made her sympathetic. I loved how she was still pretty fucking terrible. I loved how it played out. I loved that there was like this dreadlocked boyfriend for a little bit and like how everything was like perfect.
Did you think at first or at some point that Adam and Derek were a couple?
No.
I thought that's where we were going there at first.
Oh, no, I didn't think that at all. But okay. I didn't know. I didn't get that vibe at all. Because I feel like this is one almost sort of played with like the rom-com genre, right? Like it's like sort of a fucked up like rom-com.
Dark rom-com, edgy rom-com. That's a new
But it like sort of did. It was like, oh, like girl goes to New York City, like ends up with a child, but finds a way to make it work. You know, obviously like
as a drug mule,
right? And it's like the dark part of it is like as a drug mule in like a shady business, but there and it's like falls in love with like young entrepreneur, like they all live together in this great loft, and then shit falls apart. I just like it worked with the conventions that I like to try again. Like I just thought it really worked.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's.
I was doing a little practicals because I was like, is she ever going to take this kid to the doctor? Is that when it's going to like all fall apart? He's not getting his well child visits right now.
Yeah. He needs a vaccine or two. Like, what's going on? Has he had his shots?
Right. But you know, and so then when they produced like the fake birth certificate and all of that stuff, I was like, okay, she could really get away with this, right? Yeah. She could totally get away with it. And then like my heart really sank when she was searching and she found his father.
Yeah, me too.
And then I was like, that was hard. Yeah. That was really hard. But Danielle like kept me on my toes to the very end because I thought she was going to like ring and run with the kid.
Mm-hmm. I thought she was going to go.
I didn't know that she was going to like bail on her friend. And because by bailing on her friend, now there's somebody who could connect her. So she's really going to have to disappear. You know what I mean? As opposed to if her friend thought she just left with her kid and she never heard from it again. But anyway, writing the letters and those sorts of things, like I did not anticipate that. But it, you know, that scene was really heartbreaking too when she puts the baby to bed for the last time.
It just was so good. Okay, let's do the novella, The Office of Historical Corrections. Okay, I have to just say this right now because I am never this person, but this is the one story that I got ahead of. I knew where it was going. I figured it out pretty early. And I'll tell you how I figured it out. And I don't know if this was on purpose or not, but Chase or whatever, the white supremacist boy, when they're talking about him and the woman who owns the shop,
right?
Danielle Evans refers to him as a nephew of that woman, except for they share the same grandma or something. So they're really cousins. And when she did that, I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but it made me think, oh, something's not right with this family tree. I wonder if they're black. Like literally that one thing, because I am obsessed with family trees. Like, I can tell you if someone's your first cousin once removed or your second cousin, or, you know, like, I can do that whole thing. And so there was something about the family tree, because I think what it was is actually that she said, it's my nephew. But then she said that the dad was her, like, cousin or something, or like her uncle was his dad. And so that's not your nephew, that's your cousin. And so in that moment, I was like, oh, something's not right. I bet there's black people here. Like, I literally was like, I bet somebody's black somehow. And like, and then I was just like waiting for it to play out. So I don't know, but I don't know if she did that on purpose, because I don't think that I'm smart enough to do that on my own. So I think maybe she was trying to leave some breadcrumbs or something. I don't know.
I missed that. So you're sharp. I totally missed that part. You know, one of the things that I felt sort of shades of with between Jeannie and the main character, and why do I suck at character names?
Cassie, but, or Cassandra or something?
Yeah. Jeannie and Cassie, they were giving me Belle Lettres from The Heads of the Colored People.
Yes.
The two black
girls. Yes.
I felt like that, you know, that sort of era again, or that sentiment. And initially I was like, oh, I hate that they're being pitted against each other. Mm-hmm. And then they have, but then it's rivalry doesn't even seem like the right word for mm-hmm. it, but it was so interesting to me, mm-hmm. you know, like when she said to her, like she was just so blunt. Jeannie was just so blunt, but Cassie acknowledged she was blunt, but she was right. She was right when she was like, oh yeah, I get that now. Like, you were the only black girl I know that was raised to be happy. I was like, God damn. Like, oh my God. You know, like,
don't you feel like half of the time I'm Cassie and half of the time I'm Jeannie, right? Like, sometimes I'm so mad and like, I can be blunt and I can be in your face, but I'm also right. You know, mm-hmm. I'm like, I want to be acknowledged for that. And then sometimes I'm Cassie where like someone will be like, oh, X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, fuck, I really blew that. Like, I'm not being a good fucking black person. Like, I'm not holding it down in the right ways.
I mean, I feel like I'm trying to grow into Jeannie, you know, but sometimes it's just so much easier to be Cassie, you know, kind of going along to get along. And, But I just loved the evolution of that relationship.
Yeah.
You know, kind of three stages. It was that we and I loved that we got to see them as kids, and then they're in this professional setting, and then it, you know, when they were in Wisconsin together, you know, the fact that their relationship, you know, actually shifted and they were dealing with each other, honestly, you know, and I feel like I'm glad this relationship can like heal and mend, you know, she dies.
Right. I know. I didn't see that exact ending. I didn't have the ending. I just had the passing part.
I didn't see that coming at all.
The ending was really good. Do you feel like an Office of Historical Corrections, or whatever the real name is, do you think that would be a good idea? How do you think that would play out in our world?
Well, it would frustrate me no end because, I mean, and Danielle alluded to it in the introduction with, you know, talking about an era where truth was being, you know, the truth was in shambles. I mean, I don't remember what her exact words were, but it enrages me that in this moment, truth doesn't matter anymore. Mm-hmm. And so if we had something like that, and people also ignored that, then I'd just be angrier. Nobody wants that. I mean, when you coined the term alternative facts, I mean, all the corrections in the world won't matter to people who simply don't want any other narrative than the one that they already have. And they don't want any narrative that's going to make them uncomfortable.
Right.
And so, you know, this mythical, or you know, this fictional Office of Historical Corrections, you know, Institute for Public History, I love the concept of it, but I'm just so cynical that it wouldn't even make a difference nowadays.
And I also think I love the idea of it as well, but I also think, like every other government institution or whatever, you know, it would be run by fucking whoever. I'm not going to name a politician, but you know, like it would, right. It's not like it's being helmed by Cassie and Jeannie. It's being helmed by some fucking, you know, oh, this, we got this one wrong. We have to go back and fix it. Da da da. Like, I just, I think it would, but what I like about it is the idea that, at least of the story, is that this idea that like minor historical errors can change the ways that we think about things and ourselves. And like the example with Juneteenth, where it's like Juneteenth is a fundamentally different holiday and it says a fundamentally different thing about Blackness in America if it is celebrating the Emancipation Proclamation versus if it's celebrating the day in Galveston, Texas, when Black people who had been slaves for extra 3 years finally found out. And I've never really thought about that small distinction, but I'm sure for a lot of people who aren't Black, who never heard of Juneteenth, they thought it probably was for the Emancipation Proclamation, right? And like that is a different holiday and a different thing. And there's so many of these little tiny historical errors.
Right. And I think when you point those kinds of things out, what you want is for white people to say, huh, I wonder what else I don't know. Mm-hmm. I wonder what else I've taken for granted. I wonder what else, what other assumptions I've made that have, that keep me ignorant. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And as opposed to coming from a place of, I know everything. I, you know, there's nothing, you know, that they can't be educated. You know, there's that quote from Martin Luther King is that the problem with the, you know, with white moderates, I think he said white moderates is, or just white people, is that they don't think that there's anything they need to be educated about. And that's dangerous.
Right.
You know, and so I love this, the idea of that institute, because it exists to say that Americans in general are just ignorant of history and that you need to question everything you thought you knew and be curious about what you didn't know and how does that impact how you show up in the world.
Right. Right. Because the response that I've so often experienced with white people is like, oh, you got this thing wrong or whatever, that's not accurate, is like, it's not even just that, or like the response is often, I got it wrong, but that's what I was taught. Like, there's no curiousness. There's no like, oh, like I feel like when I learn that I got something wrong, I'm like, let me go on Google and just fucking go nuts. Like, all I want to do. Right. Like, that's how I became a whiz in family trees, is that I was like, what the fuck is a cousin once removed? And then I looked it up and I was like, oh my God, I can figure the whole thing out. Like, and it's just that, yeah. Okay. I know we have to go. So I want to just do the last thing that we always do, which is what did you think of the cover and the title?
So when I first heard the title before I got the book or got into the book, I was, it just immediately made me curious. Mm-hmm, so same. I think it's a great title in terms of, you know, drawing a reader in. And then I love the text on the cover, there's that handwriting. Mm-hmm. This is a novella and stories. And then, you know, so part of it is typeface. And the other part is, you know, it appears to be handwritten. I don't know, like, it doesn't connect to the story, you know?
Yeah.
But I can't think of an alternative. Like, you know, a great cover for this would have been, you know, I can't suggest anything else about it, but I did like the handwriting because it ties to how intimate these stories are.
Yeah,
so I did like that.
I like the handwriting because I think it ties also to like notes. Like, it's like, this is the text and I'm just adding these little notes, like correcting the record, like adding little thing. I agree. I love the title. It was super intriguing to me. I like the way that the cover looks, but it doesn't give you any clues. Except for possibly like the color being painted across, like the blue, pink, yellow, the stripes is sort of like either highlighting or like crossing off in a way. Like there's something there. It just doesn't quite translate for me. I like it. Like, I think it's a beautiful book. I'd be happy to have it in my collection, but I don't know if the title or the cover connects in an obvious way, which I think is hard also with stories. Is there anything else you want to say about the book or the stories or anything?
I have a question for you. Did I miss something? What is the meaning of the title of the second story, Richard of York Gave Battle?
I have no idea. I didn't get that either.
I thought it was me. Okay.
No, I didn't either. I was like, I have no idea what this means, which is why I could never think of the title of the story, which is also part of the reason I think the story didn't stick with me as much, because I couldn't place it in my mind. But no, I don't know. If anyone knows, please let us know. You can me and tell me. This was such a treat, Disha. Thank you so much for taking the time and the care to discuss these stories with me. And just, everyone, if you haven't read Disha's book yet, it's called The Secret Life of Church Ladies. It's out in the world. It was a National Book Award finalist. That means it's good. So go read it. Disha, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me and for the opportunity to talk about this book and happy 2021.
I know, we made it. We have a new president as of this airing, just FYI. Yay for us. Yay. And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you so much to Disha for being our guest today. All right, here it is. The February Stacks Book Club is The New Wilderness by Diane Cook. We will discuss this book on Wednesday, February 24th. Please tune in next week to find out who our guest will be for that discussion. Make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review the show. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Sebastian Alcala is our sound editor and producer. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirajits. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.
One third of all murder cases in America remain open.
He had told me that if I opened my eyes, he would slit my throat.
Each one is called a cold case.
The DNA evidence taken from the victim was a match. The linen rapist was at it again.
Based on the hit A&E television program.
A phone call is placed, one that changes a family's life forever.
Cold Case Files, the podcast.
If you could see the fire in his eyes, he screamed at me. You want it? Get your tape recorder out.
Get new episodes of Cold Case Files every Tuesday on Podcast One, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere you listen to podcasts.